All right. Well, you know what? Maybe I'll stand. Since I'm vertically challenged, I'll maybe stand and see all of you. Nice as this throne is, I mean, you know, it really is a great honor and a pleasure to be here. In a way, he's described my expertise in the past. On the future, everybody's really a kind of expert. And it's a great challenge to ask a historian to speak about the future, because if you actually look at the history of prophecies about Jews, they're almost all proved wrong. It's amazing. The very first mention of the name Israel that we have, it goes back to Pharaoh Merneptah. So it goes back about 1230 before the Common Era. It's a kind of prophecy. It reads, Israel is laid waste, his seed is wiped out. But of course, as we know, things worked out rather differently. It was kind of the pharaohs who were wiped out, and Israel lives on. Moving to America, one of the wisest leaders, he was attorney general. His name was William Wirt. He later ran for president. In 1818, William Wirt predicted that within 150 years, Jews would be indistinguishable from the rest of mankind. Of course, didn't work out that way. Today, it's William Wirt who's indistinguishable, probably. Nobody here ever heard of him. And again, the Jewish people lives on. Still more recently, this, some of you will remember, Look magazine, in a famous cover story in 1964, wrote about the vanishing American Jew. I think every rabbi in America must have preached on the vanishing American Jew. But in the meanwhile, Look itself has vanished, not just once, but twice. And again, the Jewish people lives on. In short, I think I quoted this morning, as the great Jewish philosopher Yogi Berra once pointed out, prophecy is very difficult, especially about the future. And you should certainly keep that in mind as we proceed. What I want to do this evening, as time allows, is to talk about certain transformations that have affected American Jewry, and I think will affect it in the 21st century. And then I want to point to certain areas of uncertainty concerning the community's future, areas where the evidence isn't in and visions are contested, and the future is really being shaped by the actions of contemporary Jews. But certainly, these are the challenges that we as a community have to think about. Now, the first thing that anybody who talks about the future inevitably talks about is demography. And I think we, at this point, know pretty clearly that in the 21st century, the American Jewish community is shrinking, both absolutely and as a percentage of the overall population. We had a new population survey a couple of years ago. Many of you heard about it, the 2001 Jewish Population Survey, and that pegged the Jewish population at about 5.2 million. The population survey is a very contentious subject. It's like exit polls for the same reason that the one is a problem, the other is a problem. People don't like to answer the phone anymore, and they don't always tell the truth. As an aside, though, and you should tell this to the exit pollers if anybody's here, the best line on exit polls came from an Israeli. In Israel, they've long been known that the exit polls and all polls are wrong, and I heard it myself on the television. They interviewed the guy, and what he said was, Israelis tell the truth to the pollsters and lie at the ballot box. So I don't know if they tell the truth to the National Population Survey or not. But the point is that at 5.2 million, Jews are less suddenly than 2% of the population. And that represents a very substantial decline since their peak. Jews peaked in the 1940s when we were about 3.7% of the population. It's also a reminder there's no correlation between political power percent of the population. Jews are far more involved in politics today. They're 11, we're about 10% of Congress. I think 11 senators. It's astonishing. But certainly the Jewish population has been, relatively speaking, in decline now for about more than half a century. And since America's population is still growing pretty fast, and the Jewish population, alas, isn't growing at all, in fact, maybe going in the other way, the other direction, it's safe to predict that Jews are going to be a smaller and smaller percentage of the American population. What's important about the National Jewish Population Study, what just happened, is this is the first time since colonial days that the number of Jews in America actually declined. The number had been stable for a very long period of time since the 1960s. We'd always said there are between 5.5 and 6 million Jews, and suddenly that drops. And there are several surveys now that say it dropped, and it makes perfect sense that it should have dropped, since we have a very low Jewish birth rate. It is below a zero population growth. The Jewish birth rate's about 1.7, 1.8. Replacement of a population is 2.1. You see all those 0.1 kids running around. Now you know why. And since we are below zero population growth, and immigration is radically down. The reason the Jewish population was stable for 40 or so years was because of immigration, whether it was from Russia, the Soviet Union. We had about 500,000 Jews from the Soviet Union, the number is disputed, or other places, even from Israel, South Africa. I noted quite a number of South Africans in this community. But especially in the last few years, immigration began to decline in the late 90s, especially after it became more difficult for Russian Jews to come. And after September 11th, immigration has collapsed. So immigration is not going to keep the numbers up. And then we have the effect of non-marriage and late marriage and intermarriage. We'll talk more about some of those. I'll say as a parenthesis, I believe that when we really write the history of the community, the effect of non-marriage will turn out to be as significant, if not more significant, as intermarriage. A number is perfectly obvious. Intermarriage, the children may be Jewish, may not be Jewish. Non-marriage, there rarely are children. There's begun to be a movement of single women having children. In Israel, it's a quite significant movement, and the question is, will it become significant in America? But so far, it's an insignificant movement, and usually single people don't have children. There are good reasons for that, and therefore, the numbers fall. But I think that the drop in numbers will be a very significant fact. Now, those of you who follow the world Jewish scene know that this is a big theme in Europe. Anglo-Jewry, that's all they talk about. Anglo-Jewry dropped from about 400,000 to, according to some, as low as 275,000 just in one generation. A quarter of Anglo-Jewry disappeared. Many of them went to Israel, and others, simply the community didn't reproduce itself. The diaspora as a whole has been dropping, according to the Israeli demography. Has a wonderful name, I love to say it. Sergio de la Pergola. That's a name. According to him, it's been dropping at 0.8% a year. And there's no reason why American Jewry should be immune from those trends. The question is, how important is it? So one scholar argues that it's not something to worry about, because what's happening is that the American Jewish community is becoming, in his words, leaner and meaner. That means it is declining numerically, but those that remain are better educated Jewishly and more committed Jewishly than ever before. This is kind of the ideal corporate scenario of the 21st century. We downsize in order to get stronger. So I have to say, though, I won't comment, you might know better, on whether it's a good scenario for America, but in terms of Jews, I have my doubts. In the world of religion, when faith communities cease to grow, when their numbers decline in absolute and relative terms, very often pessimism takes hold. They lose their vitality and their spiritual freshness. And if you want some examples, think of Christian Science, once a very vibrant movement in America. You hardly hear about it. Or the Quakers. It's just, I mean, in our memory, look how important the Quakers were in Vietnam. You haven't heard of Quakers, and the reason you don't hear of Quakers is their numbers declined radically, and the few you meet are actually Jews, and you know, they disappear. And the truth is that mainline Protestantism has similarly been on the decline and lost the spark. So the question is, can Jews be different? I do have some concern that cutbacks in the population can be have a demoralizing effect, especially when we see that other faith communities, the Mormons, the evangelicals, the Catholics, are growing. If you want to see an example of demoralization, I mean, look internally, look at the conservative movement. They see Reform growing, they see Orthodox growing. They have become a little demoralized. I would like to see them improve their morale. I'm speaking at the RA this year, and I'm going to do my best. But drops in numbers have an impact. And that leads to another transformation, and that is the question of significance of the Jewish community. And there, too, I think we are seeing some changes. Now, in a way, you could argue we've never been so significant on the national scene as we are now. As I mentioned, we're about a tenth of Congress, two Supreme Court justices, and several Jewish governors, including Hawaii, not elected by the Jewish vote, I assure you. But at the same time, we are seeing other changes. Into the 50s and 60s, American Jews really saw themselves as part of really a kind of religious triad celebrated by Will Herberg in a book called Protestant Catholic Jew. Not to be a Protestant, a Catholic, a Jew, Herberg wrote, is somehow not to be an American. And, you know, Jews, in a sense, thought they were about a third of America. And and we spoke about America's Judeo-Christian heritage, which again included Jews among insiders and everybody else, non-believers and Muslims and Buddhists and so forth. They were outsiders. They weren't on the nation's religious screen at all. Well, today, nobody would argue that we are Protestant, Catholic, Jew. None of the conventions, if you watched them, had a Protestant, Catholic, a Jew. They had the widest range of religious folk come along. And Herberg excluded a great many important people. And we pay a lot of attention, especially in California, to religious outsiders. And we should pay attention to them. They're growing very fast. Islam is one of the nation's fastest growing religions. They have managed to immigrate. Most Muslims have immigrated under the new immigration laws came into effect in the 1960s. There is every likelihood, although today I don't think there are as many Muslims as Jews. The best estimates are 2 to 3 million Muslims. I think there is a good chance there'll be more Muslims than Jews at some point in the 21st century. And we, of course, have Asians, religions, and the like. So the world of American religion is changing, and the result for Jews is a decline in our status, where once we were America's third faith, today we are one of many minority faiths. And that's a big difference. You can tell it. There's a a book. In fact, it's written by somebody out here, J. Gordon Melton. He produced something called The Encyclopedia of American Religions. It's really a remarkable book. It divides America into 1,588 primary religious groups. Who would have thought there are so many? I mentioned it. Someone from the ADL said, how can we have so many interfaith satyrs? Anyway, 1,588 religious groups, which he then subdivided into 19 families of religion. And what's fascinating is only 10 of those families are Christian. All the rest are not. But what interested me is that Judaism didn't rate a religious family of its own. It was grouped in the book along with Islam, Sufism, Zoroastrianism, and Baha'i as part of the Middle Eastern family of American religion. Now, I have to tell you, I find that bizarre. Somebody spends too much time in Southern California. You'll forgive me, but maybe they lose sight of the way things are. But I do think that it anticipates challenges that do lie ahead. I don't think American Judaism is going to be seen as America's third faith or America's fourth faith, but I think what we increasingly see are a vast number of religious options in America, and Judaism is kind of one of those options, a kind of smorgasbord. The other really important transformation in terms of status, which we haven't begun to think about, and we should, is the fact that Israel will very soon, within the next few years, overtake America as the nation, as the world's largest Jewish community. There are a few hundred thousand difference, according to some, none at all. Israel says there are about 5.1 million Jews in Israel. There are 5.2 million in America. This is nothing. And Israel still has a high birth rate and immigration rate. In fact, this is little known. There are already more Jews in Greater Tel Aviv than in Greater New York. And that's, to my mind, very significant. The rise of New York in the 19th century anticipated America's rise to centrality, and I think we will one day say that the rise of Greater Tel Aviv anticipates the fact that Israel is rising. Now, from a Zionist point of view, of course, this is unbelievably good news. This is the ultimate triumph of Zionism. It will mark the first time since the days of the Bible that Israel will truly be the single largest Jewish population center in the world. Remember, in the days of the Second Temple, Babylonia was larger. But for American Jews, I think we have to think what the impact is going to be. What will be the effect of downward mobility, of moving from being the greatest Jewish population center in the world, the center of world Jewry, merely to second best? It's moving from Hertz to Avis. And I think it will affect the way Jews feel about themselves. I think it will affect our relationship to Israel. I think it will affect our sense of responsibility for the world. You can see this. Much of the discussion, all of you have heard speeches about the Israeli diaspora relationship. What's really going on is it's like, you know, when your teenager one day is taller than you are, and that changes the relationship. And, that's what's going on with the state of Israel. And we haven't actually thought out very well as a community what the implications are. What is Israel's role in the world? What is America's role in the world? When Argentinian Jewry went into crisis, American Jewry didn't do very much. There was a sense, now maybe Israel should take care of it. Actually, Israel didn't do that much either. So you know who went and took care of it? Chabad. And Chabad has become enormously influential in Argentina because they went down there. I think that what we're really seeing is this realignment. Nobody quite knows what will result, but I think that it will be one of the big stories, so to speak, of the 21st century. Now, a third transformation, which is of great interest to me, is really the transformation of the diaspora. there is a tremendous disjunction between the image of the diaspora in the contemporary Jewish mind and the reality of the diaspora as it now exists and I think will continue to exist. That is to say, most of us assume Jews are everywhere. Yeah, the rabbi goes off to China and Japan, he'll come back, talk about the synagogues and the Jews he met. The Jews are everywhere. We are Am Olam, a global people. And, we were once described as omni-territorial. And I think a lot of non-Jews believe that, too. Jews are everywhere. And that's an amazing fact. But the truth is that the map of the Jewish world has been substantially redrawn, partly, alas, because of the Shoah and partly because of post-Holocaust migrations. And Jews have never been as concentrated as we are today. 95% of diaspora Jewry is confined to 14 countries. If you get bored, see if you can name them. There are only 38 countries that have more than 5,000 Jews. If you don't have 5,000 Jews, hard to be a really ongoing community. Most of the 200 countries or so in the world are completely barren of Jews, and that, of course, includes places where Jews had lived for a very long time, Iraq, Syria, Ethiopia. They're barren of Jews or show communities that are totally unsustainable. There are huge areas of the world that actually have no Jewish presence whatsoever. That's why the UN can make all sorts of statements about Jews and Israel. They don't know any Jews. Most of the world's countries don't have Jewish communities, or they're tiny communities that are unsustainable. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing. The vast majority of the world's Jews since World War II have moved to economically affluent, politically stable, and socially attractive environments over the last 50 years. So they've abandoned, they moved to Southern California and so on. They've abandoned underdeveloped countries like Yemen, and unstable, dangerous countries like Afghanistan, except for those two Jews who they found to quarrel with one another. Or Bosnia once had a Jewish community, no Jewish community left. And today, most Jews live in the world's most economically advanced countries like America, like France, like Israel. But this benefit really comes at a price, and we have not thought about that price at all. Most of the world's great religions, Christianity, Islam, Eastern religions, are today expanding. Judaism is contracting. Other peoples are preaching the gospel of globalism and spreading their diasporas north, south, east, and west. We Jews, who invented the very concept of a diaspora, it is a Jewish invention, we are reducing our exposure to the Jewish world. We are practicing consolidation. And this raises very significant questions about what our policy should be in the years ahead. Should we strengthen Jewish life in the diaspora? Should we move out in new places? By the way, Chabad, I mentioned them earlier, Chabad is the movement that disagrees with this consolidation, and that was an act of ideology. The Lubavitcher Rebbe believed that it's better to put your eggs in a lot of different places, because if you're persecuted here, you can go there. Most of world Jewry has voted differently. Let's put our faith in first world countries. But I think we need to think about these issues and be aware of them. It is a very great transformation in terms of Jewish history as a whole, where we have really removed ourselves from most of the world's countries. We are not really a world religion anymore. We are a regional religion. Is that good? Is that bad? That's, something to really think about. And that brings me to a fourth transformation, and that is, more and more it seems to me that, at least in America, we are seeing Judaism that resembles Protestant denominationalism. And the result of that is that, like Protestantism, we're seeing burgeoning pluralism, greater focus upon the individual than upon the group, more permeable denominational and even interfaith boundaries, and greater emphasis on consent as opposed to the traditional Jewish emphasis on descent. That sounds very complicated. Let me explain a bit what I mean. First of all, we see a whole lot of new movements in Jewish life beyond the familiar ones. So new, and you see most of them starting out here in the West, New Age Judaism and Chavura Judaism and Humanistic Judaism and so on. The fastest growing movement in Jewish life is not Orthodoxy, not Conservative Judaism, not Reform, not Reconstructionism, although they'll tell you differently. The fastest growing movement in Jewish life is Other. Jews who write down Other, they've now reached 20% of Jews. That's an astonishing rise. And nobody's quite sure what Other means, but it's clear that more and more Jews don't want to identify themselves in one of the normal ways. We're also seeing a growth in private ordinations. Once upon a time, every rabbi either trained under Reform, Conservative, Orthodox auspices in one of the major known seminaries. Then we added Reconstructionism. Today, there are a growing number of private ordinations, Zalman Schechter, or the Academy of Jewish Religion, or the new, or another rabbi, just an individual rabbi, or the new rabbinical seminary in Boston. And I suspect that those trends will continue. They actually parallel what's going on in American religion generally. We also see a growing number of, in fact, one of you asked me about this, growing number of one-generation Jews. We never had such a phenomenon in Jewish life. By one-generation Jews, I mean people whose parents were not Jewish, who convert to Judaism, but who quite reasonably said, I choose Judaism, I'm a Jew by choice. My kids also have a choice. They may choose to be Buddhists. So they are one-generation Jews, converts with neither Jewish parents or Jewish children. And the point of that, that is the sense that I chose Judaism, is this emphasis on consent rather than an emphasis on descent. The emphasis on my making an active choice, which is a very American idea, rather than automatically following in the ways of ancestors, which is a more traditional Jewish idea. And I'm not passing judgment here on it, but the move from descent emphasis to consent emphasis is very important. And of course, that's really what intermarriage is about as well. Intermarriage is a sense of consent. I will marry the person I fall in love with and I choose to marry, rather than emphasizing descent. I will marry someone who is a member of the tribe. Americans generally, much of what is written about intermarriage isn't worth reading because it doesn't pay attention to the larger world. Well, I mentioned this, I think, on Friday night in response to a question, but Americans generally are marrying across religious and racial lines in record numbers, and it's no great surprise that Jews are doing the same thing. And the result of that is that we may indeed see a Judaism that comes more and more to resemble the religious patterns of our neighbors, which, with all sorts of denominational switching, that is to say, the Jewish population will churn as eager newcomers enter the Jewish fold and dissatisfied veterans seek out greener religious patterns. And the important impact here, and we are seeing it, is the Jewish peoplehood. The notion of Klal Yisrael, the idea that all Jews are related to one another and care about one another, this is an endangered Jewish value. It is not a value that our neighbors know, and it is often not a value that converts to Judaism really understand. They're taught about Jewish holidays and the Sabbath and prayer, but not about Klal Yisrael. And there are now quite a few studies that that suggest that only about half of American Jews resonate to the idea that they are responsible for all Jews around the world, and that persecuted Jews elsewhere are their responsibility. The other half of American Jews don't understand that value, and that has very, very serious implications. It is really an endangered Jewish value, and we're either going to strengthen that Jewish value, or we will find that something that distinguished us from our neighbors, it's not a value that Christianity knows at all, will no longer distinguish us. Well, let me turn rather quickly now to areas of uncertainty. The first area of uncertainty I'm not going to say anything about, and that, of course, is Israel and its future. Indeed, we're uncertain as we speak. I don't know what will happen when Mr. Arafat disappears from the scene. Will they all fight one another? Will there be a civil war? Will it unite? I do think, however, that what has happened in the last few years, contrary to what we were all predicting in the late 90s. In the late 90s, when we were, it shows how bad prophecy is, we assumed that peace was at hand, that we sort of had a sense of what that peace would look like, and indeed, the American Jewish community began to focus inward. You dismantled the United Israel appeal. You assumed that the community was now going to have a new set of priorities. And then, much to everybody's surprise, all of the old priorities kind of came back with a vengeance. So we began to worry about Israel, and we began to worry about anti-Semitism. And that, again, began to dominate Jewish life. I suspect now, with the Intifada waning, that we're going to see a move back in the other direction, but it is truly unpredictable. The one point I do want to make, and it's much discussed in the elite levels of the community, is the fact that we now have a generation. You have to understand, I'm using generation in a narrow term. We have a generation of Jews who did not go to Israel in the prime time of going to Israel, which is a few years between the end of high school and kind of the end of college. They're about 4 or 5 years where people often used to spend a year in Israel. We've lost a whole group that did not go to Israel in that time and therefore doesn't know Israel. And it turns out that the group that had experience of a year in Israel, they are today the leadership of the American Jewish community. So having a generation that didn't spend a year in Israel is a very significant challenge to us as a community. It's something Israel is very worried about. It's something we all have to be worried about. The second question, which I know is on your mind and you would have asked me if I don't mention it, is the issue of politics. How should we view the election in terms of the Jewish vote? I have a somewhat unorthodox view of this, and that is that whether you like the result of the election or not, the good thing about the election is both the Democrats and the Republicans, I think, will come away saying our strategy in terms of the Jewish vote paid off. Why? The Republican strategy was to try and get more Jewish votes because in a very close election, every vote matters. That's very good for us as a small group. And Jews turn out in large numbers. They also contribute in large numbers. And since Jews live in significant numbers in precisely those states that they needed, Florida, Ohio, Michigan, all have Jewish communities of significance, they wanted to increase the number of Jews for the Republicans. Well, if you look at the exit polls, not as gross figures, which is what the JTA reported, which was the move from 19% to 24%, doesn't sound like very much to Bush, but if you look at the exit polls, you see a very interesting thing, and that is that the Jewish vote for the Republicans increased significantly by 9 points in the Midwest, by, I think, 7 points in the South, and hardly changed at all in the West and the East. That is to say, in the very states that the Republicans needed votes from Jews, they got them. And if you look at Florida's key counties where Jews live, there are three counties where Jews live, they needed a landslide for the Democrats in order to overcome northern Florida. You know the paradox of Florida. In Florida, northern Florida votes like the South, and southern Florida votes like the North. So you needed a landslide for Kerry to overcome that. They never got that landslide. So the Republicans will come away, I think, saying, our effort to get the Jewish vote, it wasn't as good as we wanted. They wanted 35%. And remember that the most favorite Republicans over the years, Eisenhower, Reagan, got 39% of the Jewish vote. That's the peak, 39-40. They didn't get anything close to that, but I still think they will say it paid off. At the same time, the Democrats will be able to say, the Jews voted for us more than any other minority group. You know, we used to say Jews vote. Jews earn like Episcopalians and vote like Puerto Ricans. That was Milton Himmelfarb's famous line. Can't say it anymore. We vote more Democratic than the Puerto Ricans. The Puerto Ricans have moved to the Republicans in large numbers. Jews haven't. The only racial group that is more Democratic than Jews or blacks. Blacks were more Democratic again, second election in a row. Jews voted approximately like gays. 23% of gays voted for George Bush. I don't specialize in that population. Can't explain it. Love to understand it, but can't. And 24% of Jews voted for George Bush. So the Democrats, I think, are going to feel vindicated as well. And the reason that's a good thing is, as a Jewish community, it is very much in our interest, I believe, for both parties to believe that the Jewish vote is up for grabs, for both parties to compete for the Jewish vote, to strive hard. They shouldn't believe either, as one Republican said, F the Jews, they don't vote for us anyway, which is what a Nixon aide famously once said. And it's not good for them to say the Jews will vote for us whatever we do, as some Democrats believe. Much better for both sides to woo us. So in that respect, this election, I think, will be seen as successful. But nobody really knows whether the Jewish vote is in play. There are three groups of Jews seen to be tending Republican: Russian Jews in large numbers, Orthodox Jews, and some say young Jews. I haven't seen a good handle on the young Jewish vote and how it tended in this election. Remains to be seen whether the Jewish vote will really be in play over the next bunch of years. Third, another transformation. Will the 21st century be marked by assimilation or revitalization? And it's easy, as I said Friday night, so I won't really repeat it, to make a case in both directions. Basically, one week we read in the newspaper the Jewish birth rate is down and intermarriage is up, and the next week we read about Jewish day schools bulging at the seams and new money in Jewish day schools. Everywhere I go, they show me new Jewish day schools and new Jewish high schools. Who among us believed 10 years ago that you would have the kind of group of Jewish high schools that we now have? I think you can really see that battle between assimilation and revitalization is not being decided, in heaven. That's being decided on the ground wherever Jews live. And it's fought out, I think, day by day, community by community, Jew by Jew. All of the discussion of continuity and renaissance and all these nice words are really the question of what is our direction, revitalization or assimilation? And, programs like Ari's here are really designed to push one of those directions. But that's really the battle that we are involved with. The third question for the future is the question of whether the Judaism in the years ahead will be characterized by religious polarization, a people divided, as Jack Wertheimer calls them, or return to the vital center. And again, I think on the one hand, it's easy to make the case for polarization. We all know it. We see it. We see a huge number. This is a huge issue. Huge number of Jews who are considered Jewish by some groups, not considered Jewish by other groups. We've never had such a serious situation in Jewish history with hundreds of thousands of Jews all over the world in that kind of limbo. Israel is deeply polarized. That has a polarizing effect on American Jewry. It's easy to make the case. But never forget, on the other hand, that the vast majority of Jews in America are actually somewhere in the center of the religious spectrum. And I define that center as somewhere from centrist Orthodox to centrist Reform. Jewish lay people are deeply concerned about all the divisiveness in Jewish life. They are appalled by communal schism. And they're a very strong force, I think. And we can see interesting development. A word I never heard a few years ago, but now I hear it all the time because everybody in Boston loves it, trans-denominational. We have a trans-denominational school and a trans-denominational rabbinical seminary and on and on and on. Trans-denominational is very antithesis of polarization. There's some, I don't think this election helped, but there was some sense of America moving back to the center. Bill Clinton was supposedly this proof of their moving back to the center. It didn't work out as well as prophets claimed, as you probably noticed. But nevertheless, I think it's an important question. Will we see a move back to the center? That, by the way, would be very good for the conservative movement. Conservative movement suffered when the center dropped out of culture. So the conservative movement, which represented that center, also, I think, had problems. Will we rediscover the center, or will Judaism polarize just as the country is so polarized? It was kind of nice to hear various speeches about bringing everybody together, Mr. Obama on one side, Mr. Bush on the other. But it's going to take more than rhetoric to make that happen. And again, in the Jewish community, that's going to depend upon us. The last area of uncertainty, and then I want to open it up. Will American Jews in the next century be able to find a mission compelling enough for us to become passionate about and rally around? The great missions of the 20th century, whether it's immigrant absorption or saving European Jewry or creating and sustaining a Jewish state or rescuing Soviet Arab and Ethiopian Jews, they are behind us. And today, for the first time in historical memory, that's a very strong statement. It is true. For the first time in historical memory, there is no large community of persecuted Jews anywhere in the diaspora. When was there such an era? But I don't think, on the other hand, that my students at Brandeis are going to get the kind of meaning from helping Israel or keeping alive the Holocaust or fighting anti-Semitism that we did. And really, a lot of those themes are behind us. And what we have seen is a lot of secular causes and universal causes that American Jews are embracing: social justice, environmentalism, world hunger. We had a memorable demonstration of Brandeis students a few years ago who declared they would rather go naked than wear fur. Those are, however, significant. The causes, they're not Jewish causes in the way Zionism or the Soviet Jewry movement certainly were. We are poorer as a diaspora Jewish community for not having a well-defined, elevated mission to inspire us. And I think it's very important for us to think about that kind of mission that can inspire young and old the way some of those earlier missions did. But I want to conclude on a much more optimistic note. The good thing about being a Jewish historian is that I know that Jewish history is full of problems and crises and anticipated catastrophes, far worse than anything we have described here. Jews are the people who invented that famous joke about the telegram that reads, "Start worrying, letter follows." I actually have to tell that joke because soon people ask me, what's a telegram? So but the fact is that we have over and over again defied the odds and continue to survive. And that testifies, I think, that we are highly attuned to potential problems. As I said on Friday night, complacency is a luxury that we Jews cannot afford. So even if we are, if historians like myself are occasionally pessimistic about the future, Jewish history gives us great cause for optimism. We have overcome much worse. In fact, we have overcome and survived one doomsayer after another. And we have survived, I think, not by belittling or ignoring prophets of gloom and doom, and certainly not by reciting, you know, Tillim, reciting the Book of Psalms, or saying, Mashiach now, the Messiah will come and save us at the last minute. I actually think we Jews have survived because time and again, we have carefully analyzed the problems that we face and have moved to resolve them by changing our ways, creating new institutions, recovering old ideals. The value, perhaps, of inviting a historian to look ahead is that it encourages us to focus on the challenges that the Jewish community faces. But as for the future, it's really going to depend upon those, including, I hope, many of you here in the room today, who have the vision and the fortitude to shape the future. So I hope we all do a good job. Thanks very much. And your question.
Okay, we're going to take a few questions. So, if anybody has anything they want to ask, either about tonight or any other
anything you always wanted to know.
For this century, with the given that the American Jewish community is the biggest Israeli supporter and politically in this country, with the demographics of the Muslim population in this country.
It's, of course, it's one of the great questions. In Europe, we already see that the great growth of Islam has had a huge impact. And the question is, what will be in America? I think September 11th changed it a bit in two ways. Number one, not only is there no more Muslim immigration to the United States, it's really been cut off, it's a certain amount of out-migration of people who become disenchanted. The second, as you point out, is that the efforts to figure out the Muslim, to organize the Muslim community have not been terribly successful. There are two very conflicting polls that crossed my computer on Friday about the Muslim vote, radically different. One argued that 28%, that means more Muslims than Jews, voted for George Bush, which would really suggest, that was a Zogby poll, and Mr. Zogby knows that community, although his exit polls were widely criticized. That would indeed suggest that they weren't able to get the Muslims to vote en masse against. The other vote, which I don't believe, the other poll put out by CAIR, C-A-I-R, which is the most important Islamic organization, but utterly, to my mind, unscrupulous. They said some 91 or 92% voted for Mr. Kerry. All I can say is where we have very good data, which is in the previous election, they weren't able to come together. In a sense, if we see this new coalition of evangelicals, there are 100 million of them, supporting Israel, that is going to be much, much stronger than the small number of Muslim votes. On the other hand, everything we know about American politics is that small groups can have a significant effect. The problem the Democratic Party had this year, I'm the guy who said it at the Democratic National Convention, and everybody said, shh, shh, but of course it was true, is that the Muslims were the low-hanging fruit in this election for the Democrats. And so the problem the Democrats had was how to get those Muslim votes without alienating the Jewish vote. And there was an easy solution to that problem. Don't talk about the Middle East. That's why John Kerry said so little about the Middle East. That was the only way he could get both sides. So already in that respect, the Muslim voters had an impact on the Democrats. But I think that, you know, that's about what we can say about the Muslim population. I think it's somewhat in flux. A lot is going to depend on what happens in the world of terror in the next few years. Were we to see significant terror in the United States, it would be very ugly for American Muslims. I wish that were not true, but you just look at American history and you know that that is true. If, on the other hand, the war against terror becomes a great success and we don't have a repetition, then I think the Muslim community will organize and strengthen and will probably become a more significant force. Yeah.
You mentioned the evangelical Christians. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the what you see as the relationship between the Jews and the evangelical Christians, because on the one hand, you know, obviously in Israel, they're aligned, but on a lot of other issues, they're not. And especially with the increasing political activism of evangelical Christians in areas like the Ten Commandments and, you know, and so forth.
Okay, no, it's a fair and important question. In one way, it's the oldest question, I mean, in Jewish life. That is to say, do we make coalitions that are short-term with people who share our immediate interests, or do we only make coalitions with those whose values, you know, we are really in sync with? It's the same issue in politics. Ted Kennedy, should he make coalitions with conservatives for particular ends, even though he disagrees on so many other things? Is politics the art of the possible? Or do you really only go to bed with people whom you deeply care about and agree with? And that debate has gone on in Zionism from the beginning, and it's the same debate. And it's a tough issue, I think, for the American Jewish community. In a way, it's going to divide the same way the election divided. People who said Israel is my absolutely top priority say, you know, they support Israel, we like them. And it's easy, all right, yes, Pat Robertson hopes we'll all convert, but, you know, when the Messiah comes, we'll ask you, is it your first visit or your second visit? And then we'll know. Till then, I can happily engage with you. So that's one issue. The other argument, of course, is we disagree on any number of issues with evangelicals, and that trumps Israel. And, you know, that was the issue in the election. That's the issue in the community. The issue of the Ten Commandments, somebody asked earlier in a small group. Let me just say, I think that we have argued that issue wrong. And let me tell you why. The issue, what most people don't realize, is that Protestants, Catholics, and Jews do not share the same Ten Commandments. There aren't Ten Commandments. The Hebrew is Aseret HaDvarim, 10 statements, and if you actually count, there are 13 commandments there. And Jews, Protestants, Catholics number them differently. Ask your Christian friends, what is the first commandment? Every one of them will say, thou shalt have no other God beside me. But Jews believe the first commandment is, I'm the Lord thy God. And then do the same with other numbers, and you'll quickly see, or you can take out the encyclopedia and see three numbers. We also don't agree on the translation. Is it, thou shalt not kill? Or thou shalt not murder. Boy, that makes a difference. By the way, it's thou shalt not murder, but nevertheless, the King James says thou shalt not kill. I think that most Americans agree. I really think there's a very broad agreement that it is not up to the legislature to say the Protestant translation is right, the Catholic translation is wrong, or the Jewish count is wrong, the Catholic count is right. We don't want our government doing that. Most people agree. We have not done a very good job of explaining the real problem of the Ten Commandments. And even the Supreme Court's famous case in Kentucky didn't mention this. Everybody assumes, of course, we all share the Ten Commandments. When you say, listen, you think it means thou shalt not kill. I think it means thou shalt not murder. There's a huge difference. One suggests we should be pacifist. That was one of the big explanations of pacifism. The other suggests something very different. I think most Americans will agree we shouldn't have the courts deciding it. And it's our job, since we know Hebrew, to help them understand it. In other words, we have to think much harder. Instead of being lockstep about church-state separation and, you know, and just as a mantra, we have to think much harder about these issues and how to present them in ways that will make sense. And we have to probably think about whether we want to fight every issue. As I said earlier today, I don't know why the Jewish community got exercised on a moment of silence. I really don't. I think there should be lots of moments of silence in most schools. And I think it was the silliest issue for us to oppose. It was a very good means for different faiths to be satisfied. So we're going to have to think harder about those issues and not just, you know, mouth kind of old ideas without thinking about them, but really think about ways of making clear why the Ten Commandments shouldn't be in the public square, but maybe finding other things where we can find an accommodation for religion, like the moment of silence. Yeah.
Last night you said something about when economy trumps religion, mm-hmm. it's the first sign of modernity.
Right.
In this last election, it looked like it was the other way around.
Well, that's a curious. I thought you were going to say something else. So naturally, I'll say what I thought you were going to say, because that's easier. The Intifada is the great example of religion trumping economics. The Intifada made no economic sense. Everybody lost, the Arabs worst of all. And just the proof of it, if you're ever in a library, take out the Jerusalem Post on the first week of September, on the very year the Intifada broke out, 2000, and you will see that there's an article there proving that the Arabs will never attack Israel because they have too much to lose. The casino in Jericho, all of those Arabs who were getting rich, selling to Israelis, you know, every Shabbat, and that the two sides had far too much economic tie, and that was what was really going to bring about peace. It was a great theory. If you believe that economics is destiny, it was right, but it was wrong because, in a sense, their religion trumped economics. The problem of looking at the last election economically is that it's just not clear how many Americans really are persuaded that things have gotten worse for them. The Democrats had trouble making that case. And in Ohio, you know, some people believed it, but of course there were other people whose taxes had gone down and who didn't believe it. It's the economic situation, even the numbers are hard to gauge. I mean, if you ask me personally, the rising deficit, to my mind, spiraling out of control deficit, is something that we're going to be paying for a long time. But most Americans, as indeed the vice president said, you know, Ronald Reagan proved that deficits don't matter. That's a lot of malarkey, but it means Ronald Reagan proved that Americans don't care about deficits. When we start having massive inflation again, which is what happened last time we had a massive deficit, then I think it's going to have a big impact. But remember, no president can run more than two terms, so you know, then it ceases to matter so much to incumbents. So I don't know that I could interpret it. I'm a little nervous about this interpretation of the election, that it's all about values. First of all, that was a weird poll, badly phrased. And second of all, only 28% of the people said that moral values were their issue. And I'm afraid if we all buy into that idea, we will forget that it was a very complicated election. I think some people, I mean, I know Jews, many Jews who voted for George Bush, but not one of them voted for George Bush because of values or gays. All of them talked about Israel. And I know, you know, other people in Ohio who supported it because the war on terrorism, which I think was strong, or because we've got to support our boys in Iraq. So I'm very wary of that poll and of believing it too strongly. And I think that you could draw a lot of wrong conclusions, and probably both parties will, yeah.
The good professor
which said that on almost every level, Jewish education is up. The number of Jews who study in day school, who among us, just a prophecy, who among us would believe, 10 years ago, that of all of the major kinds of education available, Sunday school, supplementary school, and day school, that more Jews would be in day school than in the other two? That doesn't mean it's an absolute majority in day school, but today more in day school than supplementary school, more in supplement, or than in Sunday school. And it's not just there. You know, once upon a time, and I don't mean long ago, Jews had a very sophisticated knowledge of the secular world because they'd gone to college, and a pediatric knowledge of Judaism because they quit at age 13. Today, every university has the Jews go to has Jewish studies, and the average Jew, according to the population study, the average Jew takes at least one course of Jewish studies at university, which means you have a somewhat more sophisticated understanding of Jewish studies. The growth of adult Jewish learning, Wexner Heritage, Melton Mini School, the Meir program, these are sophisticated Jewish education. CSB, right. These are sophisticated, right. Jewish studies, sophisticated Jewish studies programs of a kind that didn't exist for adults 20 years ago. So I think that that just as Orthodoxy reaped an enormous harvest from its investment in day schools, I mean, that's an amazing phenomenon. If you want to understand why Orthodoxy began to turn around, it is because they created, through day schools, a learned laity that wanted to be Orthodox. Now we have other movements doing the same thing. So I think that from what we've seen of the investments, I think that is the best investment. Now, I know there are other people who argue about that we should put money into outreach, and there are other alternatives. I do not myself think we should put all our eggs in one basket. I tend to think that the lesson of previous revitalization movements is that we can't predict what is going to succeed, and therefore it's good to put eggs into a variety of baskets. But education has certainly turned out, and it's no great, you know, wonder if you know Jewish history, to be vitally important to the community, and that would be my answer. Yeah.
I'm going to take two more questions.
Okay, I see what
I
that
I want to move out of politics. You talk about decrease of Jewish population in the world. Mm-hmm. We know, that, for example, that in India, you have a tribe that claim that they are descendant of the tribe of Menashe. And there is a big discussion, should we accept them or not? What is your opinion?
Well, there's a man in Israel who spends his life really running around finding tribes, not just in India, but in Africa and all over, which he claims are descendants of Jews. I think one of the big issues in the years ahead is going to be the question of how we relate to these groups. They have to want to be Jewish. I don't think we should, you know, sprinkle water on a tribe and say, oh, poof, you're now Jewish. But we have a huge number, as I said, of people who want to be Jews. Look, Russian Jews, I don't have to go to India. The vast number of Russian Jews who were persecuted as Jews, see themselves as Jews, but are not Jewish by halachic standards, is a huge issue. And there's a growing majority in Israel that believes you've got to find a way to make them Jewish. Whether that is a kind of emphasis more on the ritual side of conversion than on the taking up the commandments, or to put it differently, will be more like Hillel than Shammai. Remember Hillel, when the potential convert came, he told him one commandment, all the rest is commentary, go and learn. But he converted him. Shammai drove him away. I myself think we do need to be more like Hillel than Shammai, and that those who want to come, we should be very good about bringing in, and especially in Israel, where the environment strengthens you. Okay, you may say in America that's harder because the environment draws you away. But in Israel, I think the environment works in your favor. And I tend to think, at least when I was in Israel for the year, I had a sense that the current situation won't last long. And I would not be surprised if we see either an end to the current religious kind of monopoly, in which case there will simply be rabbis who will do it, as you have in America, or you'll have some other solution to the problem. But I think there is a stronger and stronger view that some solution has to be found. I'd like to think so. I guess that's the last question. Yeah, please.
I'm asking you as a professor, what's your assessment of the biggest issues confronting college students, Jewish college students, on campus right now?
Yeah, the biggest issue confronting college students, I mean, I mentioned the fact that we don't have a mission and so on, but the immediate issue is the fact that many campuses today are very alien, I mean, frightening places for Jews, that the enemies of Israel have taken over while we were asleep college campuses. This happened most in Middle East studies departments. I mean, we really, a whole generation paid no attention, and we know exactly it was done. You just watch Arab Money. They bought Middle East studies, and it's just an astonishing phenomenon what has gone on, how they were politicized, and Israel was demonized. Israel's not part of the Middle East, according to them. And I mean it. We hired a few years ago a very young scholar to teach Islam. I was the chair of the department. He came to see me when we were interviewing, and he said, if I come to Brandeis, in addition to teaching classes, would you permit me to take courses in Hebrew? So, of course, I said, of course, we'd be thrilled for you to do this. But since I'll mention the college, since I said to him, I saw you went to Concordia University, why, and you did Middle East studies, did it occur to you to take Hebrew at Concordia? And he replied, I very much wanted to, but my professor told me that Hebrew is not recognized as a Middle Eastern language, and I would get no credit for it. Well, and this at a major university. And these kinds of stories go on. There's now a film about what is going on at Columbia University in Middle East studies. Now, it's begun to change. And the way it's begun to change is by Jews giving money for Israel studies. We need to strengthen Israel studies. Every department of Middle East has to have someone in Israel studies. And we have to train people. Brandeis University now has this remarkable summer program to begin to train people in Israel studies. It will take a generation to do this, but eventually, once we have Israel studies back in the Middle East, and we focus on what's going on in Middle East studies so that the terrorist in Florida who was in Middle East studies eventually, you know, thrown out. It was a whole issue in the Florida campaign. And other folks like the one at Columbia, we will focus light on them. And we won't be quiet, and that will change it. But it universities change slowly. There are things called tenure. I rather like tenure, but nevertheless, not always a good thing. And it will move slowly, but we have to work on that. And I think today, students who have to choose colleges very carefully, because there are universities where Jewish students find it deeply uncomfortable. But again, and I want to close on this point, I sometimes feel people come to hear about the future believing that, you know, I have a crystal ball. I'll tell you the future. You go home, you watch it on CNN and see if I'm right. Everything I've tried to say tonight is to reverse that. We shape the future. The future doesn't just happen. If we shape it well, we'll have a future that our children and grandchildren will benefit from. If we stay home and watch CNN, then the future will happen without us. But I have a sense that we Jews still understand that the future is something we will shape, and I'd like to be hopeful, and again, so I hope we do a good job in shaping that future. And I think we've done pretty well in the past. Learning from the past, we'll be able to shape a future that our children and grandchildren will be proud to occupy. Thanks very much, and Ari here shapes the future.